The ship cuts through calm water, but the mood on board is tight. Ministers lean over briefing tables as the engines hum beneath their feet. Outside, the Caribbean looks untouched. Inside, every conversation circles the same damage left behind by Hurricane Melissa. Roofs torn away, airports slowed, hotels dark, time lost. This is not a cruise for leisure. This is a working vessel turned conference room. Tourism leaders and cruise executives meet at sea because land is still rebuilding. The pitch is blunt. Ships can move fast. Ships can bring people. Ships can restart cash flow while islands recover. But speed carries weight. Deals made here will shape who benefits and who waits. Every promise of recovery raises another question about control, dependence, and long-term cost. The horizon stays wide and blue, but the pressure is real. What happens on this ship may decide whether the region rebounds stronger or simply floats until the next storm hits. Chapter 1. At sea under pressure, the ship eased away from port just after sunrise. Its scale was impossible to miss. Multiple decks rose like stacked neighborhoods, glass and steel catching early light. This was Icon of the Seas, repurposed for something far from leisure. Inside, conference rooms replaced poolside chatter. Security badges replaced drink packages. The hum of engines became the backdrop for policy talk. Tourism ministers from across the Caribbean arrived in tight clusters. Some had flown in the night before, others boarded at dawn. Their faces showed strain that did not lift with the ocean breeze. Hurricane Melissa had passed weeks earlier, but its weight still sat heavy. Several islands were still dealing with damaged airports. Power grids remained fragile. Hotels that once anchored local employment were closed or operating at reduced capacity. The decision to meet at sea was deliberate. On land, the gaps were too visible. Damaged terminals, empty resort corridors. Here, movement itself became a message. The ship could travel. The ship could operate. The ship could host thousands, even while ports struggled. That reality framed every discussion before the first briefing even began. Inside the main conference hall, long tables were set with folders and tablets. National flags stood at the edges of the room. Cruise executives took their seats alongside public officials. Port authority leaders joined quietly, many carrying their own concerns about repairs and timelines. No one wasted time on ceremony. The opening remarks were brief and direct. A senior tourism official outlined the situation plainly. Hurricane Melissa had disrupted peak season recovery. Airlift capacity was still uneven. Insurance payouts were slow. Smaller operators were at risk of collapse. Cruise tourism, the official said, had returned faster than any other segment. Ships rerouted, schedules adjusted, passengers kept coming. That speed mattered. Cruise arrivals brought immediate foreign exchange. They filled taxis. They moved tour operators back to work, even if only for a few hours at a time. In several ports, cruise visits had resumed within days of the storm. Hotels, by contrast, faced months of repairs. Some would miss the entire season. Cruise executives reinforced the point. Their fleets were mobile by design. They could shift itineraries away from damaged ports and then back again once basic services were restored. They could supply their own power, water, and logistics. In disaster terms, they functioned as floating infrastructure. But the room was not convinced by speed alone. A minister from a smaller island state spoke next. Cruise calls had resumed quickly, yes, but local businesses still struggled to access passengers. Shore time was limited. Spending was controlled. Many excursions were sold on board, with revenue flowing offshore before a visitor ever stepped onto the dock. Another minister raised a different concern. Cruise recovery, while visible, risked masking deeper damage. Stayover tourism employed more people long term. It supported farmers, cleaners, maintenance crews, and small suppliers. A recovery measured only by ship arrivals could hide rising unemployment on land. The briefing shifted to data. Charts showed passenger numbers rebounding in cruise-heavy destinations. Hotel occupancy lagged behind. Islands with diversified tourism bases showed slower but broader recovery. Islands dependent on a single port or single cruise line faced sharper swings. No one disputed the numbers. The question was interpretation. Were cruise ships a bridge or a crutch? By mid-morning, the ship was fully underway. Outside the windows, the horizon stayed calm. Inside, tension built quietly. Ministers spoke of resilience and partnership, but their language tightened when discussion turned to control. Who decided which ports returned first? Who set excursion terms? Who absorbed risk when storms intensified? One official referenced past storms without naming them. Each time, the pattern repeated. Cruise tourism returned fast, headlines followed, recovery was declared. Then, years later, structural vulnerabilities remained unchanged. Ports expanded, debt increased, local ownership shrank. Cruise representatives responded with caution. They emphasized collaboration. They pointed to investments in port upgrades and terminal facilities. They noted training programs and community initiatives. They avoided commitments. This meeting, they stressed, was about alignment, not contracts. Still, the imbalance was clear. Cruise lines controlled assets that governments did not. Ships, scheduling power, passenger flow, the ability to bypass or include a destination with little notice. That leverage sat quietly in the room, unspoken, but understood. As lunch approached, conversations broke into smaller groups. Some ministers spoke privately with executives. Others huddled with advisors. The talk turned practical. Dock repairs, berth depth, shore power access, emergency protocols. Each technical issue carried political weight. A Port Authority director described working through the night to reopen a damaged pier. The cost was high, the payoff uncertain. Without a confirmed return of ships, the investment was a gamble. With ships, the port gained relevance but also dependency. The ship continued forward. The irony was not lost on anyone. A moving vessel hosted discussions about fixed islands struggling to rebuild. The contrast sharpened the stakes. Mobility versus immobility. Capital versus exposure. Speed versus sustainability. The session closed with a reminder. Hurricane Melissa was not an anomaly. Climate models pointed to stronger storms and shorter recovery windows. The region could not afford repeated resets. Whatever model emerged from this summit would shape not just recovery, but survival. No decisions were announced, no commitments signed, but lines were being drawn between immediate relief and long-term reform, between partnership and power, between what could be done quickly and what needed to be done right. As the room emptied, the ship pressed on. Behind it, islands rebuilt in stages. Ahead, negotiations deepened. The question left hanging was simple but heavy. Would this floating solution help the region stand firmer on land, or would it teach leaders to keep rebuilding at sea? Chapter 2, The Promise and the Friction. By the second day, the tone had shifted. The first morning had been about urgency and framing. Now the talk narrowed to mechanics and control. The meeting moved into smaller rooms tucked deep inside the ship. Doors closed, phones stayed face down. What was said here would not make the opening statements on shore. Cruise executives opened with capability. They described how fleets had been repositioned within days of Hurricane Melissa, how supply chains followed ships, how passenger confidence rebounded faster than airlines expected. Charts showed routes lighting back up across the region. The message was consistent. Cruise tourism could move now, not months from now. A senior executive spoke about scale. One ship could deliver several thousand visitors in a single call. Multiply that across a week and the numbers added up fast. Local taxis ran, guides worked, vendors sold. The cash cycle restarted, even if briefly. Tourism ministers listened without interrupting. When the floor opened, the questions came sharp and controlled. One minister asked who decided which ports returned first. Another asked how many local operators were locked out of onboard excursion contracts. A third questioned how much passenger spending actually stayed on the islands once fees and commissions were deducted. The answers were careful. Cruise executives pointed to safety assessments and port readiness. They spoke about global standards and liability exposure. They emphasized that decisions were operational, not political. But no one in the room missed the reality. Control flowed with ownership of the ships. Data was brought forward. Analysts compared post-storm recovery curves. Cruise arrivals rebounded quickly. Hotel bookings lagged behind. Employment patterns showed uneven gains. Short-term jobs tied to ship calls returned faster than full-time hotel work. The numbers confirmed what many ministers already felt on the ground. One island representative described a port bustling on cruise days and quiet the rest of the week. Vendors earned income in bursts. Farmers and suppliers saw little benefit. Infrastructure costs stayed fixed while revenue fluctuated. Recovery looked strong from offshore, but fragile inland. Another minister raised the issue of leakage directly. Cruise tourism, they said, brought visitors but exported profits. Shore excursions were packaged on board. Retail spending clustered near terminals. Local ownership remained limited. In a recovery phase, that imbalance mattered more, not less. The discussion grew tense. Cruise executives defended their model. They pointed to investments in terminals and piers. They cited training programs and partnerships. They noted that without cruise calls, some ports would see no visitors at all, while airports remained constrained. A Port Authority official spoke next, bridging both sides. Repairs after Hurricane Melissa had been costly. Temporary fixes drained reserves. Permanent upgrades required financing that governments struggled to secure. Cruise commitments helped unlock loans and justify spending. Without them, ports risked falling behind regional competitors. That dependence hung heavy in the room. Ports needed ships. Ships did not need every port. The meeting paused briefly. Outside, the ship cut a steady path through open water. Inside, the conversation resumed with climate risk added to the equation. Storms were arriving stronger and more frequently. Recovery windows shrank. Insurance premiums rose. Infrastructure built for yesterday's weather faced tomorrow's reality. Cruise representatives spoke about adaptation. New ships were designed with resilience in mind. Flexible itineraries reduced exposure. Onboard systems allowed self-sufficiency when ports were compromised. From a risk perspective, cruise operations absorbed shocks better than fixed assets on land. Ministers countered with a different concern. That same flexibility allowed cruise lines to disengage quickly. An island could invest heavily, suffer a storm, and still be dropped from itineraries if conditions were not favorable enough. The risk was asymmetric. One minister described a scenario already unfolding. A damaged port reopened just enough to receive ships. Tourists disembarked for a few hours. Photos circulated. Headlines spoke of recovery. Meanwhile, inland communities waited months for rebuilding funds. The perception of recovery delayed aid and shifted attention. The room went quiet for a moment. No one disputed the example. It captured the core tension. Cruise tourism delivered visibility and speed, but it could also distort reality. A cruise executive responded by reframing the issue. Cruise-led recovery was not meant to replace land-based tourism, they said. It was a bridge, a temporary stabilizer, a way to keep economies moving while deeper rebuilding occurred. That word bridge became central. Ministers pressed on how long the bridge would last. What conditions defined the transition? Who decided when to shift emphasis back to stay over tourism and local enterprise? No clear answers emerged. The conversation circled back to control again and again. Contracts, access, revenue sharing, emergency protocols. Each technical issue reflected a larger power balance. As the session stretched into the afternoon, fatigue set in. Voices stayed measured but firm. The stakes were too high for theatrics. What was unfolding here would shape policy language and investment signals across the region. One analyst summarized the dilemma bluntly. Cruise-led recovery worked best when paired with clear guardrails. Without them, it risked entrenching dependency. With them, it could buy time for reform. The problem was that guardrails required leverage, and leverage was uneven. The meeting ended without resolution. No agreements were announced, no frameworks finalized. But lines had hardened. Ministers left knowing that speed came at a price. Cruise executives left knowing that scrutiny was rising. As the doors opened and participants filtered back into public spaces, the ship continued its course. Outside, the sea remained calm. Inside, the friction had surfaced fully. The next question was no longer whether cruise tourism could lead recovery. It was whether the region could shape that leadership on its own terms. Chapter 3. After the dock lines, the final morning began without ceremony. No grand opening, no applause. The summit had moved past framing and friction. What remained was reckoning. Participants gathered knowing that whatever emerged would be incomplete, but still consequential. The closing session was held in a smaller room. Fewer observers, fewer aides. The mood was restrained. Statements were now measured for what they would signal once the ship returned to port. Every phrase carried weight beyond the room. Tourism ministers spoke first. They emphasized resilience, partnership, shared responsibility. The language was familiar, but the context had sharpened it. Hurricane Melissa had exposed structural weaknesses that could no longer be managed quietly. Infrastructure gaps, insurance shortfalls, labor vulnerability, climate exposure. These were no longer abstract risks, they were active pressures. Crew's executives followed. Their tone shifted from capability to continuity. They reiterated commitment to the region. They spoke about long-term presence, not short-term deployment. They referenced ongoing port projects and future itinerary planning. Nothing was promised outright. Everything was positioned as collaborative. Behind the words, the unresolved questions lingered. Who defined long-term? Who bore risk? Who controlled pace? An independent economist was invited to present an external view. The assessment was blunt. Cruise-led recovery provided liquidity and visibility, but it did not rebuild housing stock. It did not restore inland supply chains. It did not replace full-time employment lost when hotels remained closed. At best, it bought time. Buying time mattered, but time without direction could be wasted. The economist warned against mistaking motion for progress. Ship arrivals created headlines. They reassured investors. They calmed markets. But they could also delay hard choices. Tax reform, land use planning, insurance restructuring, climate adaptation funding, those decisions were slower and politically costly. Several ministers nodded. The room understood this tension well. Recovery was not just economic, it was reputational. Declaring stability too soon could undercut leverage for aid and reform. Declaring instability for too long could scare off investment. Climate risk entered the discussion again, this time without hedging. Storm intensity was increasing. Recovery cycles were compressing. Ports built today might face major damage within a decade. Cruise infrastructure was more resilient, but also more mobile. Fixed assets remained exposed. A Port Authority director described the dilemma plainly. Invest heavily to meet cruise standards and risk debt exposure, or delay upgrades and risk exclusion. Either choice carried consequences that extended beyond tourism. Cruise representatives responded by stressing shared planning, joint risk assessments, integrated emergency protocols. They framed cruise lines as partners in resilience, not just beneficiaries. They pointed to ships serving as temporary shelters and supply hubs after storms. That role was acknowledged. No one dismissed it. But it raised another question. If ships could function as emergency infrastructure, did governments risk outsourcing resilience itself? The discussion turned to governance. Several ministers pushed for clearer regional frameworks, minimum standards for local participation, transparent excursion access, data sharing on passenger spending. None of this was framed as confrontation. It was framed as sustainability. Cruise executives listened carefully. Some expressed openness. Others cautioned against overregulation. Flexibility, they argued, was what allowed cruise tourism to respond quickly after Hurricane Melissa. Constraints could slow response when speed mattered most. The room recognized the trade-off. Regulation could protect local interests. It could also introduce friction during crises. The balance was delicate and unresolved. As the session neared its end, the language softened. Public-facing statements were drafted. They spoke of unity, of rebuilding together, of preparing for the next storm rather than the last. These statements would be released once the ship docked. They would shape headlines across the region. Privately, participants acknowledged what the statements would not say. That cruise-led recovery was neither solution nor threat by itself. It was a tool, powerful, uneven, capable of stabilizing economies and distorting them at the same time. The ship began its return toward port. Outside, land came back into view. Some islands showed visible damage from the storm. Others looked unchanged from a distance. The contrast underscored the summit's core problem. Appearances misled. As participants prepared to disembark, conversations turned quieter. Advisors discussed next steps. Ministers weighed domestic pressures. Cruise executives planned schedules months ahead. Each group operated on different timelines. No agreements had been signed on board. No binding frameworks announced, but positions had shifted. Questions once avoided were now on record. Expectations had changed. The dock lines were secured in the afternoon. Cameras appeared, smiles returned, statements were read. The language was hopeful, resilience was emphasized, partnership reaffirmed. Beyond the microphones, the work remained unfinished. Recovery would continue unevenly. Some ports would thrive quickly, others would lag. Cruise ships would keep coming. Hotels would reopen slowly. Communities inland would rebuild on their own schedules. The summit at sea had clarified one thing. Cruise-led recovery could buy the region time, but time alone was not enough. What mattered was how that time was used, whether it led to transformation or simply postponed the next reckoning. As the ship emptied, the Caribbean returned to land-based reality. The sea had offered motion. The future would demand footing.